Hello, welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Sarah. And I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop update on the treatment of ovarian cancer. And today's program is supported by GEMNAB and made possible through an independent grant from Merck and Company, Inc. And I really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, before I introduce our first speaker, I just have a few things I'd like to do with all of you. First of all, we have over 203 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have a number of international participants from India, Lebanon, Philippines, Saudi Arabia, Uganda, and the United Kingdom. So it is truly a global call. And we're delighted that all of you have chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now I would like to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Carolyn Runowitz. Dr. Runowitz is Professor Emerita, Obstetrics and Gynecology, Herbert Wertheim College of Medicine, Florida International University. And Dr. Runowitz will be addressing overview of ovarian cancer, including staging, and guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, follow-up care, quality of life concerns, and discussion of open notes. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Runowitz.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, for including me in this important teleconference. I am honored to be among such prominent panelists and look forward to participating. Ovarian cancer is traditionally referred to as a single entity. However, it consists of a heterogeneous group of neoplasms with multiple histologic subtypes. All patients with a diagnosis of epithelial ovarian cancer, irrespective of their family history, should have testing for hereditary cancer syndromes. For example, the BRCA1, BRCA2, Lynch syndrome, and others. This is important to discuss with your healthcare team. Most ovarian malignancies are derived from epithelial cells. Those are subtypes which include high-grade serous, low-grade serous, endometrioid, clear cell, and mucinous. The remainder arise from other cell types, germ cell tumors, sex cord tumors. Those we will not be addressing on today's call. Dr. Lai will review the pathology in more detail and the importance of a pathologist as a critical member of the healthcare team. High-grade serous epithelial ovarian cancer, fallopian tube, and peritoneal carcinomas are clinically considered a single clinical entity, and that is due to their shared clinical behavior, their treatment, and perhaps the etiopathogenesis of these tumors. There is now current thinking that ovarian cancer actually may arise in the fallopian tube in a large percentage of cases. Staging is determined at surgery, and this is very important. In general, ovarian cancer confined to the ovary or pelvis is considered early stage and designated as a stage 1 or 2. Stage 3 is the most commonly diagnosed stage, where the tumor has spread to the peritoneal cavity outside of the pelvis. Patients with early stage disease, that is, disease that's confined to the ovaries and there are no malignant cells in the ascites or in the peritoneal cytology, which are washings the surgeon takes at the time of surgery, they benefit from removal of the adnexal mass and a complete surgical staging. The surgical staging requires specific training. That surgery is best performed by a gynecologic oncologist who is specifically trained in these debulking, that is, removal of all the gross tumor, and staging procedures. Patients with disease beyond the ovary benefit from this extensive surgery by a qualified surgeon. Following surgery, the standard approach to treatment for women requiring first-line chemotherapy for epithelial ovarian cancer is to use a platinum agent with a taxane. For women whose disease is optimally reduced, and we define that as less than 1 centimeter of residual disease, there are two options. Intravenous, that is chemotherapy that is given through the vein or the port, or a combination of intravenous and intraperitoneal chemotherapy, that is chemotherapy that is delivered directly into the peritoneum through a special catheter. For patients who do not have optimally debulked, they're considered suboptimally cytoreduced, and that's defined as residual disease greater than 1 centimeters. IV treatment is preferred over a combination of IV and intraperitoneal therapy. Enrollment in a clinical trial is another important option. PARP inhibitors, in addition to conventionally dosed IV chemotherapy, as maintenance may be given in select patients, even those patients without a known BRCA or BRCA2 mutation who have a high risk of recurrent disease. For example, those with pleural effusions or ascites. For women with a serous or high-grade endometrioid ovarian cancer, completing first-line chemotherapy with a complete or partial response, a PARP inhibitor, which is a polypolymerase inhibitor, for example, neratinib, following chemotherapy is recommended in accordance with guidelines from the American Society of Clinical Oncology and other organizations. Although observation only or treatment with bevacizumab maintenance are reasonable alternative. These therapies have been shown to improve progression-free intervals in ovarian cancer and will be further discussed by my colleague, Dr. Jorgensen. Neoadjuvant chemotherapy refers to the administration of systemic therapy before surgery. Neoadjuvant therapy may be offered to women who by imaging most likely have unresectable disease. And again, I emphasize it is very important that this decision of unresectable disease is made by a gynecologic oncologist. Typically, 3 to 4 cycles of neoadjuvant are administered, after which resectability is assessed by imaging. As I said before, a gynecologic oncologist should be an integral member of this treatment team in making these decisions. For patients with disease progression or recurrence, the treatment options will be discussed by Dr. Jorgensen. But I would like to emphasize that enrollment in a clinical trial is a very important option to consider. ClinicalTrials.gov provides information on clinical trials, and importantly, cancer care staff can assist you in looking through this website. It is also important that your team addresses any quality of life concerns and that you discuss them with the treatment team if they do not initiate discussion. These can range from hot flashes to sleep disorders to depression, and these can all be successfully treated. Patients can and should have access to their records. One system, Open Notes, and it's only one system, there are many, is used to improve patient access to their health information. Healthcare providers write notes after a medical visit that summarize important information about the patient and the patient's disease. These notes become part of the patient's medical record, and patients can access these notes through a secure online patient portal. Patients can also request a digital or paper copy of their records, or they can print off of the portal. Telehealth, which really became very popular during COVID, sometimes is also referred to as telemedicine, and that's healthcare provided by doctors and other healthcare providers from a distance using electronic means. Telehealth visits are typically done by phone or video and can also include email and text between a patient and their providers as long as it is HIPAA secure. It is important for the patient to prepare for these visits with written questions and specific information that they wish to know about their individual situation. Since there may be information overload on these calls or on a patient visit, if possible, have another person participate as another set of ears and can help you understand what you just heard. There have been obstacles to widespread implementation of telehealth, which largely center around licensure requirements between states. However, as I've stated, telemed helps facilitate patient access to patient visits and information. Thank you for allowing me to participate in this session. I will now turn the program back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Ronowitz. That was just a superb presentation. And as you are the first speaker, you really set the stage for today's program. And I just want to thank you very much for doing that. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Just a very stellar presentation. Excellent and very comprehensive. And our next speaker is Dr. Jennifer Jorgensen. And Dr. Jorgensen is Assistant Professor Obstetrics and Gynecology, Division of Gynecologic Oncology, University of Connecticut. And Dr. Jorgensen will be addressing current standard of care, treatment options for recurrent ovarian cancer, clinical trial updates, and new treatment approaches, including management of treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Jorgensen.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, for inviting me to participate in this important telehealth conference. I am also very excited to be on such an esteemed panel and to participate with you this afternoon. As Dr. Ronowitz has already explained, initially when a woman patient is diagnosed with ovarian cancer, they should really be evaluated by a GYN oncologist. And that is really important because the GYN oncologist has the special training that will help to determine if the patient should undergo primary surgery or primary chemotherapy with neoadjuvant chemotherapies. So as we have discussed, the main treatment approach for newly diagnosed ovarian cancer does include surgery and chemotherapy, which usually involves a platinum and taxane-based regimen. Most commonly used is carboplatin and paclitaxel. Depending on the amount and location of the cancer at the time of the surgery, at the time of the evaluation, the patient may undergo surgery first with the goal of removing as much of the tumor as possible to less than 1 centimeter in any one given spot, followed by chemotherapy. Other patients may begin with what we call neoadjuvant chemotherapy, where they will receive 3 to 4 cycles of chemotherapy to shrink the tumor as much as possible, followed by an interval surgery where all of the tumor is removed to the best extent possible, and then followed by further chemotherapy. Some patients at some centers may also undergo chemotherapy directly into the abdomen at that time of interval surgery. Lastly, some patients with more advanced ovarian cancer may receive bevacizumab along with their chemotherapy. This is a special kind of drug that helps block the blood supply to tumors and can be used in the maintenance therapy as well. For those patients with early stage ovarian cancer, oftentimes chemotherapy following surgery is sufficient treatment, and they will enter into surveillance where they are seen frequently by their physician to assess for possible recurrence. Those patients, though, with more advanced ovarian cancer, may be recommended to continue into maintenance therapy. Maintenance therapy can be with bevacizumab if the patient has received that with their initial treatment, but can also be with what's called a PARP inhibitor, which is olaparib, niraparib, rucaparib. However, those are the most studied in ovarian cancer. PARP inhibitors have been shown to be very helpful for patients, particularly with a BRCA mutation, or certain tumor biomarker results. So oftentimes, at the time of diagnosis, patients will undergo genetic testing through a blood test, but we will also send their tumor for testing. And that will help us to determine if the addition of a PARP inhibitor following chemotherapy would be most beneficial to that patient. As always, we do recommend clinical trial enrollment at the time of diagnosis if that is available and feasible for the patient. Moving on to treatment of recurrent ovarian cancer. If the cancer comes back, the treatment will actually depend on how long it has been since the last treatment. If it has been more than 6 months, we consider this platinum-sensitive recurrence. So that means the cancer came back more than 6 months after the last dose of chemotherapy. In that instance, we often would recommend another platinum-based chemotherapy regimen and often can add bevacizumab, that special medication that helps block the formation of blood vessels and blood supply to tumors. We can also consider a PARP inhibitor at that time following chemotherapy. In addition, if the patient has platinum-sensitive disease recurrence and the recurrence is in a small location, she may be a candidate for a secondary surgery. So in those rare instances, the patient would undergo a repeat surgery to remove all the tumor and then undergo chemotherapy. There are several clinical trials that have been done that help us to determine which patients would most benefit from this secondary surgery, and it is usually a rare handful of patients. Most patients with platinum-sensitive recurrence will be given a platinum-based chemotherapy with bevacizumab as their initial treatment. If the cancer recurs within 6 months of the last cycle of carboplatin and paclitaxel, or that platinum taxane-based chemotherapy regimen, that is considered platinum-resistant recurrence. And that means we can't use that same chemotherapy again. And so we will employ use of other chemotherapy medications, such as pegylated liposomal doxorubicin, which is also known as Doxil. We can use targeted therapies or other chemotherapy regimens that are available. And if that patient had not received bevacizumab with previous initial treatment, then we will often add the bevacizumab to the chemotherapy that we choose, as we know that those patients have a better outcome. Newer treatment options also include antibody drug conjugates, one of which is called mirvetuximab, which has been shown to help patients with platinum-resistant recurrence disease. And they can receive this medication even after having just received one line of chemotherapy. Mirvetuximab is a special kind of drug that targets specific cancer cells that express folate receptors. And so we would determine if a patient is a candidate for mirvetuximab based on their tumor testing. There are several clinical trials currently available for patients with ovarian cancer, and this allows patients to have the opportunity to try new treatments that are still being studied and promising research results that have been shown to be effective in earlier studies move to bigger, larger studies. And we do recommend enrollment in clinical trials when possible for all patients. Combination therapies are being studied right now, so combining PARP inhibitors with bevacizumab, for example. We are exploring immunotherapy, which we haven't discussed yet. So immunotherapy is medications that help boost the patient's own immune system to fight against the cancer cells. And so combining that immunotherapy with PARP inhibitors is being studied currently in ovarian cancer. Other studies are looking at tumor vaccines and immune cell therapies, which are designed to train the body's immune system to recognize and attack cancer cells. There is one study right now looking at a virus-based vaccine combined with chemotherapy after having received the vaccine and bevacizumab. So that's a promising study out there right now in patients with platinum-resistant recurrence. Other medications that are being tested include those antibody drug conjugates, and we're specifically looking at those in patients with platinum-resistant recurrent disease. And in combination with other medications like bevacizumab. So if you are considering a clinical trial, I strongly recommend you discuss that with your doctor. You can check clinicaltrials.gov if you'd like to be proactive, but really strongly recommend discussing with your physician. New treatment regimens do bring new hope and responses and excellent treatment responses in patients, but they can also bring side effects. And so some common issues with these new medications, such as the PARP inhibitors, include fatigue, nausea, and low blood counts. Often for fatigue, we do recommend patients rest. And they can exercise as well, which can help fight with fatigue. We do have anti-nausea medications that we give to patients to help with the nausea. For low blood counts, as with all treatment options, the option to reduce or adjust the medication doses can help with that. Immunotherapy is another medication that we're studying more closely in ovarian cancer. It has been shown to be very helpful in other gynecologic malignancies, and so there's some promise here in ovarian cancer as well. Immunotherapy does cause inflammation or changes in hormone levels like the thyroid hormone, cortisol levels, and et cetera. So monitoring those levels is very important, and we often will manage the changes in those levels with medications and in conjunction with other subspecialists. But we're often able to continue those medications as well. Lastly, some therapies can cause pain and discomfort. We usually will employ a mix of pain medications such as Tylenol or acetaminophen, ibuprofen when we need to, narcotics. We also suggest physical therapy and integrative therapies such as meditation and acupuncture. Lastly, in patients who are having significant side effects from their treatment, many GYN oncologists and medical oncologists will also employ the help of our palliative care colleagues who are extremely useful and are able to help most of our patients manage their side effects from existing chemotherapy regimens and these new emerging treatment options that we have. That concludes my portion of the talk. Thank you for allowing me to participate, and I will turn it over back to you, Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Jorgensen. That was just a wonderful presentation. Stellar, actually, and you covered a lot of critical areas for patients that are participating in the program today, and I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much for that outstanding presentation. And our next speaker is Dr. Sabdo Leila, and Dr. Leila is professor of pathology and surgery, courtesy, associate vice chair of faculty affairs and development, director of surgical pathology fellowship program, director AI application for pathology, medical director, breast gynecologic and Genitourinary Pathology Service, University of Nebraska Medical Center, Omaha, Nebraska. And Dr. Layla will be addressing the role of the pathologist, the importance of biomarker testing and precision medicine in informing treatment decisions for ovarian cancer. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Layla.
Well, thank you, Dr. Messner, for inviting me to be part of this esteemed panel. And so to begin, I'll be talking about the role of the pathologist. The pathologist, plays a very important role in the diagnosis-making process and directly influences treatment decisions in the management of ovarian carcinoma. You know, there's an old saying that says, how good is a pathology, so is your medicine. So for example, if I make a mistake in my diagnosis, then all else in terms of the patient's treatment goes down the drain. The practice of pathology in diagnosing ovarian carcinoma requires considerable experience, as sometimes these tumors may involve the ovary, mimicking an ovarian carcinoma, but may really be of extra-ovarian origin, which completely changes the diagnosis and the management of these cases. Tumors such as those arising in the appendix or the intestine, breast carcinomas, pancreatic carcinomas, can all involve the ovary, and they can masquerade as primary ovarian tumors. At the same time, some ovarian carcinomas can metastasize to other sites like the axilla or the breast and can be very easily mistaken for a primary breast carcinoma, resulting in wrong treatment and management. To give an example, I had a case some time ago when I had received a biopsy from a patient's axillary tumor that had been diagnosed on the outside as breast carcinoma, and the patient had been given chemotherapy for breast carcinoma for this purpose. After completion of chemotherapy to resect the residual area, she came to our hospital for further management. And it's the hospital's policy to review all prior pathology before any definitive treatment is given. And so when I saw the patient's axillary biopsy slides, which were diagnosed as breast carcinoma, I had my suspicions that this really wasn't a breast carcinoma, but most likely was an ovarian carcinoma. So I obtained the tissue slides, and then I did additional stains and confirmed my impression that this really was a high-grade serous carcinoma of the ovary, which had metastasized to the axilla and was masquerading as a primary breast carcinoma and was mistaken as such. So this completely changed the diagnosis for this patient and also the treatment approach and subsequent therapy. The patient then required a different kind of surgery. She had to have her ovaries and fallopian tubes removed. And when that was done, they were sent to me for examination, and I was able to make a diagnosis of a primary ovarian serous carcinoma, which was still there even after she got the therapy for breast carcinoma. So ovarian tumors in general are of many different types, as was mentioned by Dr. Ranowicz earlier. Those that arise from the surface epithelial cells are called the surface epithelial ovarian tumors. Those that arise from germ cells are called germ cell tumors. Those that arise from sex cord stromal cells are called sex cord stromal tumors, and so on. Each of these tumor types has many different subtypes and grades, and the management and type of follow-up for each of these different tumors is very different. And it's the pathologist who really determines what kind of tumor the patient has, its grade, and its stage, all of which dictate subsequent management. Now, there are no good serum markers to screen for ovarian carcinoma, unlike some other cancers of the body. And therefore, if on imaging a patient is suspected to have an enlarged ovary, she may be taken up directly for surgery, and the surgeon may remove the ovary or a part of it and send that to the pathologist while the patient is still on the OR table for examination. The pathologist is then able to freeze that piece of tissue and then make a quick interpretation as to what kind of cancer the patient has, or if the patient does not have any cancer and the tumor is benign. And then based on this interpretation, which is conveyed to the surgeon, but the patient is on the OR table, the surgeon can make additional decisions. For example, if the diagnosis given is malignant, then the surgeon can take additional samples from the patient's body so as to stage the cancer to see whether it has spread to other sites. And these samples are all examined by the pathologist the following day, who then decides, after examining these very carefully, if these sites are involved by cancer. And then if they are involved, then the pathologist assigns a specific pathologic stage to the tumor. And all of these data sets, the diagnosis, the stage, the grade of the tumor, are all determined by the pathologist, and all of these dictate subsequent management for the patient. This leads us to our next topic, which is on biomarkers. As I said earlier, there are no good serum biomarkers for screening for ovarian carcinoma. There is a biomarker that you may have heard of, which is called CA125. However, this is not very specific for ovarian carcinoma. It can be elevated in lots of other cancers and also in benign conditions like inflammation involving the ovary. So although this marker cannot be used to screen for ovarian carcinoma or for diagnosing ovarian carcinoma, it can be used for follow-up. So for example, if this marker is increased in the patient's blood before surgery, and then after surgery, if the marker goes down, and then it comes back up again after a few months, then it suggests that the tumor has recurred. So this is how this marker, even though it's not specific for ovarian carcinoma, can be used for follow-up and management. Now, once the ovary has been resected and sent to the pathologist, as I said earlier, the pathologist examines that very, very carefully by taking many different sections from the tumor. And then sometimes the pathologist has to resort to using some biomarkers to be able to make a diagnosis. So some biomarkers are helpful to the pathologist in making a diagnosis. Some biomarkers are useful in determining the prognosis, like, for example, P53. And some are useful in treatment decision-making, like estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, HER2-neu, PD-L1, HRD, MMR, and others. So the expression of all of these markers by the tumor, whether the tumor expresses these markers or not, is all decided by the pathologist, either by doing the studies himself or herself, or by sending the tissue for molecular testing. To give an example, if the tumor expresses HER2-neu, then drugs that target this particular receptor and destroy the tumor cells can be used in the patient's management. Or, for example, if the tumor expresses estrogen and progesterone receptor, then anti-hormonal therapy can be given. Now, not all tumors express these markers, and so if a tumor does not express HER2-neu, then giving therapy for HER2-neu or against HER2-neu will not be effective. So that's why it's very important to test every tumor for these markers and to see which markers the tumor expresses so that the therapy can then be tailored to the patient. So this process of examining the tumor for all of these biomarkers and then tailoring the therapy based on what biomarkers the tumor expresses is referred to as precision medicine. To conclude, at my hospital, after each case is diagnosed by the pathologist, and also, once the pathologist determines which biomarkers the tumor expresses, and also when the pathologist determines the final pathologic stage, the case gets presented at a multidisciplinary tumor board conference. And this conference is attended by the gynecologic oncologist, the radiation oncologist, radiologist, and also the pathologist, who all convene and discuss the case and then decide on the best management strategy for the patient. So this concludes my talk for this particular teleconference. I'll hand it over to Dr. Messner to take it on from here.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Leva. That was really a superb presentation. You know, many of our listeners probably don't have a chance to talk directly to a pathologist or to hear all the things that pathologists do and how important they are in the healthcare team. And I think you did a great job in really explaining to people all the different aspects of being a pathologist and how that so contributes to their care. So thank you so much. I know there'll be questions to you during the Q&A. It's a stellar presentation, just excellent. And our next speaker is Ms. Kara Rogan. Ms. Rogan is a licensed certified genetic counselor. She's with the Department of Clinical Genomics, clinical instructor of medical genetics, Mayo Clinic. And Ms. Rogan will be addressing the role of the genetic counselor and different types of genetic testing for ovarian cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Rogan.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and thank you for having me today. The role of a genetic counselor is to help facilitate and guide patients diagnosed with ovarian cancer through the process of germline genetic testing. So germline genetic testing refers to testing performed on a blood or saliva sample that looks for disruptive changes or what we call mutations in the genes that you were born with. This is different than the genetic testing an oncologist may order on the tumor itself. And we find that up to 25% of women diagnosed with ovarian cancer are found to have an underlying genetic cause for their cancer. That likelihood of an underlying genetic cause may be higher in women who have a personal or family history of breast, ovarian, prostate, pancreatic, colon, or uterine cancer. For a woman that has a hereditary ovarian cancer gene mutation, their lifetime risk of developing ovarian cancer is higher than the average woman's risk, which is only about 1 to 2%. The first genes identified that are linked to a hereditary risk for ovarian cancer were BRCA1 and BRCA2, sometimes referred to as BRCA. Prior to 2013, these were really the only genes available for clinical testing. We now know there are several other genes that can increase the risk for ovarian cancer, such as BRP1, RAD51C, RAD51D, and the Lynch syndrome genes and others. And so most tests ordered these days look at all of those genes all at once. Some women who previously had negative genetic testing for BRCA1 and BRCA2 only are eligible for updated multi-gene panel testing to look at those additional genes. In addition, since about 2018, there's been the option of doing paired DNA and RNA analysis on a blood sample. And adding in that RNA analysis increases the likelihood that we might find a mutation in probably less than 1% of individuals tested, but it is considered the best technology available today. At a genetic counseling appointment, the counselor reviews what will be tested, the possible results that can be received, and what those results will mean for the patient and their family. They also discuss insurance coverage of testing and laws surrounding genetic discrimination. And then once the results of the testing are available, the genetic counselor reviews and interprets the test results for the patient and also shares the results with the patient's care team. One benefit of genetic testing is for the treatment of ovarian cancer, which has been discussed by our previous panelists. So for example, women with a mutation in one of the BRCA genes may respond better to platinum-based chemotherapy and to PARP inhibitors. Another benefit of genetic testing is identifying other cancer risks in the patient and their relatives. If a gene mutation is identified, this may tell the patient they have an increased risk of developing other cancers. And then high-risk screening or preventive measures can be implemented to prevent cancer or detected at an early stage. When a gene mutation is identified in someone with ovarian cancer, genetic testing is recommended for their blood relatives. Their first-degree relatives, such as their parents, siblings, and children, have a 50% chance of having that same gene mutation. And for relatives who test positive and have that same gene mutation, some of those same screening and preventive measures can be implemented. As someone previously mentioned, you know, we don't have great screening for ovarian cancer right now. And so when someone is identified to have a hereditary risk for ovarian cancer, we typically recommend a risk-reducing salpingo-oophorectomy, which is removal of the ovary's and fallopian tubes. One area of promise for ovarian cancer screening is a newer test called multi-cancer early detection, which actually screens for several different types of cancer on a blood test, including ovarian cancer. There is one FDA-approved product called Galleri that's currently available at an out-of-pocket cost. This particular test has not really been studied in high-risk populations, such as people with gene mutations, and it doesn't really replace standard screening or risk management recommendations. It's still really new, but I think it's a pretty exciting possibility for ovarian cancer screening in the future. And another area of promise is that there are some clinical trials right now looking at using vaccines in individuals with Lynch syndrome to prevent cancer. So definitely some promise there in the future. Lastly, genetics is a rapidly changing field. We're making new discoveries every day about the hereditary causes of cancer and how to improve genetic tests. We also continue to gain insight into the exact cancer risks associated with each gene. Genetic counselors remain at the forefront of these changes to educate patients and their providers about advances in the field. And genetic counselors are also available to help families cope with a diagnosis of hereditary cancer and empower them to be proactive regarding their cancer risk. Genetic counselors also partner closely with the rest of the care team to communicate results and current medical management guidelines. We also help connect patients and their families with available resources and research studies. So thank you again for having me here today, and I will pass it back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Rogan. That was a superb presentation. Stellar, actually, and you provided so much information about the role of the genetic counselor and all the different genetic tests that are available and more that are being developed. So thank you so much. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Ms. Cassie Spector, and Ms. Spector is an oncology social worker, and she's our breast and gynecological cancers program coordinator at Cancer Care. And she'll be addressing Cancer Care's free programs and services and how to contact Cancer Care. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Spector.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. As mentioned, my name is Cassie Spector, and I'm the breast and gynecological cancers program coordinator, as well as an oncology social worker at Cancer Care. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling, support groups, educational workshops, publications, and limited financial assistance. Individuals diagnosed with ovarian cancer may choose to supplement existing social networks by joining a support group or engaging in counseling. Many hospitals, treatment centers, and nonprofit organizations offer supportive services. Being a member of a support group can offer the opportunity to speak with others who are going through a similar experience, obtain information, as well as gain support. Currently, Cancer Care offers an ovarian cancer online support group, as well as a gynecological cancers online support group. The online support groups aim to reduce feelings of loneliness and anxiety, explore new ways of coping, increase feelings of empowerment, provide practical information about treatment and resources, and address ways to communicate with one's medical team and loved ones. Our online support groups take place using a password-protected message board format and are led by professional oncology social workers who offer support and guidance. Groups are held for 15 weeks at a time, and group members must register to join. You can register by going to Cancer Care's website, cancercare.org, and selecting our services and then clicking on support groups. After completing the registration process on our website, members can participate by posting in the groups 24/7, so 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Individuals may also experience practical and financial concerns throughout one's treatment. Please know if you're encountering such financial hardships, there's organizations that may be able to help. Cancer Care offers resource navigation services, which are short-term, strengths-based approach to a service that for both patients and caregivers nationally. A trained specialist will work with the client in connecting them with resources, referrals, and financial assistance. If you're interested in learning more about the support services that we offer at Cancer Care, I encourage you to call Cancer Care's National Hope Line at 800-813-4673 to speak with one of our oncology social workers. At Cancer Care, our oncology social workers are trained in how an ovarian cancer diagnosis can impact an individual as well as their loved ones. We're here to offer you support throughout this experience and look forward to hearing from you. It's been a pleasure to be part of this program. Thank you so much for your attention, and I'll now turn it back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Spector. That was a superb presentation and a wonderful resource for our participants on this call. So I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A, and I'm going to ask Sarah to explain to you how to queue up for questions. Sarah?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Thank you.
So I'm going to ask this question for Dr. Runowitz. How does fallopian tube cancer differ from ovarian cancer?
Well, originally we thought they were distinct cancers. However, our thinking about this has evolved, and there's a school of thought that at least the poorly differentiated, what we call ovarian cancers, have actually originated in the fallopian tube. And then they spread from the fallopian tubes to what we call the peritoneal cavity. As far as other types, not the epithelial ovarian cancers, but the germ cell tumors and other tumors of the ovary are distinctly different. But we think now that fallopian tube, peritoneal cancers, and ovarian cancers are probably all encompass one entity.
Thank you. And a question for Dr. Jorgensen. I'm fighting ovarian cancer for a decade, also had breast cancer. I've had several surgeries, chemo, Avastin. Now my doctor wants me to stay on Femara. How effective is Femara alone for low-grade ovarian cancer stage 3? I'm going to ask Dr. Jorgensen to answer this question in a general way.
Yes. That is an excellent question. We didn't really touch most on low-grade serous cancers, but we actually know that low-grade serous cancers are very responsive to hormonal therapy or anti-hormonal therapy, really, like Femara, and it is being used more and more in that treatment for low-grade ovarian cancers rather than chemotherapy. And oftentimes we are moving straight to that for patients who have advanced disease after their surgery.
Excellent. Thank you. And a question for Dr. Leela. The current administration continues to vilify science and evidence-based medicine, resulting in a concerning reduction of the federal workforce and a reduction of grant support. How do you think this will affect RTCs for ovarian cancer that are currently underway?
Yeah, I didn't quite follow the question. And what exactly did they want to ask? I mean, what is the...
So the question is, the current administration continues to vilify science and evidence-based medicine, resulting in a concerning reduction in the federal workforce and reduction of great grant support. How do you think this will affect...
Yeah, the thing is that I actually, I'm not a basic science researcher. I'm a pathologist. So I'm a surgical pathologist. So I really diagnose patient material and stuff. So I really don't do basic science research. So I'm not really involved in applying for grants and getting grants. So I can't really answer that question, quite frankly. But I do work with researchers and do supply them with tissues for their research. And so far, they haven't really expressed any concern to me because I'm listed as a co-investigator on many basic science research members' grants. And so far, they haven't really expressed anything of concern, you know, so far. But maybe that may change, you know, as we move ahead and as their funding gets reduced. But so far, I've not really encountered any issues in terms of or any concerns that they have said regarding research.
So this is Dr. Runowitz. I'd like to weigh in on that one because we definitely have had an impact. I'm sitting on a study section now that was supposed to review grants for rare diseases with grants in their, you know, third renewal accounting for millions of dollars, and we are on hold. I personally reviewed a 1,000-page grant application, which was excellent. And deserves to be funded, and that study section is now on hold. So this just really is emblematic of the issues that are coming up to our NIH and to other government employees. So I think it's incumbent upon everybody who's listening to let their senators and congressmen, women, know that research and advances in cancer, but of course other diseases as well, is critically important, and we really need to get to Washington and tell them to fund this important research.
Excellent. Thank you. Thanks so much. A question, it's a really important question. I know that that we've never before had the news impacting our Q&A, but definitely these are important questions that people are asking, and so I appreciate our speaker's collective response. I'm going to ask a question for Ms. Rogan. How can BRCA1 or BRCA2 genetic involvement in a diagnosis impact treatment?
Yeah, that's a good question. My understanding, maybe some of the other panelists can comment on this a little bit more, but you know, kind of impacts you know, eligibility for PARP inhibitors, although I do believe those are given to women that don't have BRCA mutations as well. But I think women with BRCA mutations are expected to respond a little bit better to those PARP inhibitors, and I think they also respond better to platinum-based chemotherapies. So I don't know if the other panelists have agree with that or have other thoughts on that question.
This is Dr. Jorgensen. You explained that beautifully. You're right. Patients with BRCA mutations or mutations within the pathway are expected to respond more to PARP inhibitors. And oftentimes when I personally am counseling patients with these mutations, I will talk to them about the drastic benefit that they will receive from the PARP inhibitor. It increases the progression-free survival greatly compared to a placebo. We do give PARP inhibitors to patients who do not have these mutations, but that benefit is just not as much.
Excellent, thank you. And I'm going to ask, I want to thank everyone for their wonderful questions, and I'm going to ask our speakers to provide takeaways. I'm going to start with Dr. Jorgensen, if you'd like to provide just a takeaway, that people take away from this program today.
Yes. Thank you so much. I would really encourage patients who are and loved ones who are and family members who have loved ones diagnosed with ovarian cancer to be seen by a GYN oncologist and have that person weigh in on their treatment and perform their surgery. Also, strongly encourage participation in clinical trials. We know that ovarian cancer treatment has come a long way, but ongoing research continues to help us, especially in the difficult cases of recurrence, in platinum-resistant recurrence specifically. So I do highly encourage you to consider a clinical trial. And lastly, for symptom management from treatment, please reach out to your physician, and if you're really having a struggle, consider asking for a palliative care consult, because they really are not a replacement for your oncologist, but an adjunct and just a great asset to help with that.
Excellent, excellent points. Thank you. And Dr. Runowitz?
I would like to echo the thoughts of Dr. Jorgensen and to again emphasize the importance of clinical trials and also to emphasize to the the listeners to this important section is contact your congressman, your senator, and really push for the continuation of clinical trials. I've been in this business a long time, and when I first started in the 1970s, the only drug we had was platinum. And over the ensuing 40 years, there have been many drugs, and we've learned about the genetics, and we've learned about the molecular changes, and all this has occurred through research. So really lobby your representatives to continue to fund the National Cancer Institute to continue to enhance the life of patients with cancer.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you. Excellent point. And so we're going to give you all a task to do if you want to take that on. It would be really helpful for all of you and for all patients, actually. And Dr. Avila, your takeaway?
Yeah, so what I would suggest is that patients really ask their GYN oncologist questions about their diagnosis, about their pathologic diagnosis, determine if the pathology has been read by an experienced pathologist. They should also ask as to what biomarkers the tumor expresses and if these studies have been done on the tumor, and also if there are any specific therapies for these particular biomarker-expressed tumors. So that's what I would suggest, essentially, you know.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Ms. Spector?
My takeaway would be really just to know that you're not alone, know that there's organizations like Cancer Care that are here to assist you, whether you're looking for support, or you're looking for financial assistance or practical resources, there's organizations there to assist you, as well as your medical team. So always check in with your medical team to see what resources they have available to be able to assist you.
So I want to thank our speakers. You've really been phenomenal. Although we've done this program before, your questions have been really incredible. And our speakers have been incredible. It's been a phenomenal program. Probably the best program we've ever done on this particular topic. So I want to thank our speakers and our participants. And since kind of synergy makes it so special. And also the fact that the speakers know each other and are willing to step in and add things really makes a tremendous difference as well, so that you get the opinion of many of our expert speakers. So I want to thank our speakers and I want to thank our participants. But I do want to make a few comments before we close the program. I realize that we were not able to take all of your questions just because there were so many people on the call today. So I do want to comment on that. So for those of you who had a chance to ask a question, we still encourage you to take your question back to Treating Healthcare team. Remember, they know you the best, and and you've learned a lot from the program today. So it gives you a chance to really ask a more informed question. And for those of you who are in queue and didn't get to ask your question or are thinking of a question, go back to Treating Healthcare team and ask your question. And ask questions frequently of your healthcare team and ask your questions until you get the answers that you need. Also, very importantly, it's very hard often to reach your treating physicians. During the day, you can reach them, but in the evenings, it's often very hard to reach them. So please remember that evenings, weekends, and holidays are really more challenging to reach someone. And so always check with your healthcare team who's available evenings, weekends, and holidays. You know who to call for those things. Really important. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.